religion, I've been arguing, is always, in Christianity, in the manifest religions, that is the three monotheistic religions, the story of God revealing himself, and a promise that takes place in some infinite beyond. To overcome religion is to overcome representational habits of thought and representational thought occurs because with it the notion of time is taken as having a certain form, namely a discrete past, present, and future. Hence, in order to have absolute knowing, we require a different notion of time and history. My idiosyncratic thesis is that the standpoint of absolute knowing is the standpoint of forgiveness brought to self-consciousness. Let's see if I can make that stick. Because if I can make that stick, then all the rest is just details. Why is forgiveness necessary for the phenomenology as a whole? Well, we read in paragraph 19 that after talking about the notion of serious otherness, that the life of God and divine cognition may well be spoken of as a disporting of love with itself. But this idea sinks into mere edification and even insipidity if it lacks the seriousness, the suffering, the patience, and the labor of the negative. The claim here is about serious otherness, and the notion of serious otherness is in part a claim about negativity. But, or so I want to suggest, it's even stronger than that. How serious? How seriously other are these others? The eruption of otherness, for Hegel, must be a rending of a kind which belongs to the pain of dismemberment. A rending which no mere self-assertion can heal, and that hence requires what he calls, you know, the patience and the labor of the negative, the work of the negative. Let's call it a working through of the negative, or the working through of a traumatic history. The history we've read is, in fact, a history of trauma. And in this way, the phenomenology is about nothing else than the negative, for it is about nothing else but the various ways in which human beings have posited particular objects or particular forms of life as absolute, and in each and every case have come to ruin. It is those ruins, those scattered remains, that slaughter bench, which has been our object. My contention is that forgiveness is the way in which we handle the negative. Why? Well, the simplest reason as to why is to say that the standpoint of forgiveness is, in the most naive sense, a non-judgmental standpoint, a non-moralizing standpoint, a standpoint of universal acceptance. So when I forgive you, I am already going beyond good and evil. Forgiveness is the denial that morality is ultimate. So there is something about forgiveness which is amoral. Let's put it this way. Rather than reacting to evil, we let it unfold. Okay, how do we think about this? Part of the problem here is our first thought is to think that forgiving, as I already suggested last week, is a form of forgetting, and that therefore there's something anti-historical against memory about forgiveness. And there's a beautiful expression of, let's call it, this critique of forgiveness at the end of Jane Smiley's A Thousand Acres, where the character who, A Thousand Acres is a retelling of King Lear, only in this story, Regan and Goneril are the heroines and Lear is the villain. And the character who's Regan, Rhodes, is on her deathbed. And she says, roughly, my life has been a failure. I have failed as a wife. I have failed as a mother. I failed as a teacher. I failed as a farmer. I failed in the way in which every one of the women in our family have failed. My life, in that sense, has been nothing but failure. She carries on. So, all I have is the knowledge that I saw. That I saw without being afraid and without turning away, and that I didn't forgive the unforgivable. Forgiveness is a reflex for when you can't stand what you know. Forgiveness is a reflex for when you can't stand what you know. I resisted that reflex. That's my sole, solitary, lonely accomplishment. It's hard. And I take it that Smiley thinks that's what this novel is. This novel is that. Unforgiving. And Amaury, in his chapter on resentment, in At the Limits of the Mind, argues similarly that forgiveness is forgetfulness, and he will not forgive. Clearly, I'm using a different notion of forgiveness, and I need to explain why. And I get it from Kristeva. I mean, I think it's there in Hegel, it's there in everything I've been arguing, But Kristeva in Black Sun, in a chapter on Dostoevsky, is the first person I've seen to work out this thought. And she thinks of forgiveness as the standpoint of the analyst with respect to the analysand. She says, I recognize you, this is her definition of forgiveness, I recognize you with all your faults, and I accept you with all your faults, so that those faults are not faults, and so you start again. So, just as we said last week, if faults are faults, that is, if we moralize them, then there's no beginning, then we're stuck in the past, then we're stuck in melancholy. So something about forgiveness is necessary for and allows for renewal and beginning. So Kristeva thinks that to be a psychoanalyst is to take up the standpoint of forgiveness. That is, a standpoint which accepts, or at least tries to understand, and not moralize. She thinks of that standpoint as itself equivalent to the standpoint of the aesthetic or the beautiful, because the aesthetic or the beautiful allows everything to be its object, and it tries to find a form in which to acknowledge it all. Again, beauty is non-judgment. So literature, on her account, finds the human in all its strangest, scarred, mutilated, and broken forms. And form is going to be the way in which form is going to be the way of presenting evil, presenting negativity, without judging it. So on the handout I've given you, she says at the bottom of page 206, after saying forgiveness is aesthetic, I mean, at the very top of the page, the sentence you have, that you don't have the all of, she says, that analytic listening that neither judges nor calculates but attempts to untangle and reconstruct. That's what analytic understanding does. And then she's going on to say, forgiveness at the outset constitute a will, a postulate, or scheme. Meaning exists. This is not necessarily a matter of a disavowal of meaning or a manic exaltation in opposition to despair, even if, in a number of instances, this motion may be dominant. Forgiveness as a gesture of assertion and inscription of meaning carries within itself as a lining erosion of meaning, melancholia, and abjection. By including them, it displaces them. By absorbing them, it transforms them and binds them for someone else. There is meaning. This is an eminently transferential gesture that causes a third party to exist for and through another. Forgiveness emerges first as the setting up of a form. It has the effect of an acting out, a doing, a poesis. On page 216, which you don't have, she says that forgiveness gets past the notion of emotion exactly by becoming a form of writing. That a form of writing that does not suppress or deny, but finds a way of acknowledging all that confronts it. So the thought is that a certain kind of writing absorbs and replaces the act of forgiveness as an emotional impulse with, let's call it, symbolic configuration. That is, that there's a transition from the emotional impulse to forgive into a form of presentation of what requires forgiveness. My thesis is simple. Phenomenological writing implies a forgiving regard that is given by the accuracy and the perspicuity of the writing it demands and executes. What do I mean by a phenomenological regard? I mean the method that Hegel set out in the introduction. The method that said we do not have to judge. That's how the phenomenology started. We don't have to decide to judge what is the criteria. We do not have to decide what is good or evil ahead of time. We do not have to know what the meaning is ahead of time. Rather, we are going to adopt a method whereby consciousness, right, evaluates itself and we observe. So the method of the phenomenology, which is set out in the introduction, contains two fundamental positionalities. Observing consciousness, the consciousness of the philosopher, or if you wish, the analyst, and acting consciousness without claiming absoluteness for either standpoint. So I'm claiming that from the very beginning of the book, the distinction between natural consciousness and observing consciousness has already been the structure of judging consciousness and acting consciousness with which the book ends. That the book has been from the very beginning about that relationship between Antigone and Creon, and that the entire structure of the phenomenology can therefore be a self-movement that is nothing but the return of the repressed. That's just what pushes it on. The repressed keeps coming back. So the other movement, observing consciousness, realizes that this process is a process which consciousness enacts on itself. And the job of observing consciousness is to give form to this process as a learning process. But it has to do so minimally, to use Gustavus' phrase of minimalism, by which I mean it cannot take up the position of the omniscient narrator. It cannot operate as a deus ex machina. It cannot push the narrative on. Rather, it must let
the narrative unfold via determinant negation. So determinant negation is the minimum of form that allows the other to appear without judgment, without moralizing, without positing. That's the other word for judging is positing, getting beyond ficta. So, if this is right, then to adopt the phenomenological method, which when we adopted it, we thought we were just adopting some version of transcendental idealism, namely some notion of self-consciousness, where it sets up its own notion of truth and measures itself against it. But it turns out that to operate with that dualism between natural consciousness and observing consciousness, to be a phenomenologist, we can now recognize, is to adopt the standpoint of forgiveness. In this respect, if forgiveness is, as I'm claiming, the absolute standpoint, the standpoint that gathers in all this history, writes it, lets it be. In this respect, the absolute standpoint has been with us from the beginning. Because from the beginning, you have agreed not to judge. You suspended your judgment. You suspended your capacity to determine, and you agreed to accept, which is to say, if you're an analyst, to listen. And to listen no matter what was thrown up, and to give it form. Of course, it turns out that you also are natural consciousness. So, we are taking the stance toward our own history of loss and one-sidedness. And we are coming to recognize that our own history is the history of our attempt to overcome finitude, loss, and negativity. And if you wish, the denial of the negative, the claim that there is no irredeemable loss, the denial of finitude, we can call all of that the history of metaphysics. So the type of such a history, we know, is the cycle of revenge. Revenge, again, is the model of human action that does not accept loss, that thinks that every loss must be paid for, eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Metaphysics is melancholia, the refusal of loss. If the overcoming of revenge is forgiveness, when it comes to self-consciousness, and revenge is a kind of moral melancholia, then the standpoint of forgiveness when it comes to self-consciousness must be the standpoint of mourning, of recollection, of a gathering in of all the dead. Which is just what Hegel says absolute knowing is. Right? It's the picture gallery. It's the gathering up of the path we have already been through. So philosophy cannot be philosophy and be just.
to be philosophy, it must be beyond justice. Kristeva suggests that perhaps it's a fullness of justice, justice beyond justice. At any rate, it is certainly to claim that there is a fundamentally therapeutic aspect to the phenomenology, because it is nothing but a working through of this history and a overcoming of melancholia and a learning to mourn. The absolute, which recognizes this process as mourning, occurs only now. And this is why Hegel says over and over again that our time is a period of transition to a new era. That is, only now can history begin, that is, start anew, because up to now, roughly, we've had the causality of fate, history occurring behind our backs, and we've not taken responsibility for that history because we've denied that we are that history. And in denying that history, we cannot either go forward or backward, we can only repeat melancholia. Absolute knowing, then, is a mourning of a kind, and a kind of course, achievement, a recollection and working through of that past that has been formative for our coming aware of ourselves as historical beings. So that what we thought of as history out there, right, the one thing happening after another, must now be perceived as recollection. That is, a recollecting of ourselves. That is, the recognition that I am this history, and that my possibilities of living are nothing but the possibilities that are deposited in that history, and that I would not be here without it. So the recollection is neither a possession nor a disavowal, but literally a work of mourning. Absolute knowing, Hegel says, is not going to give us a new content, but the acknowledgement of everything that has occurred as a work of recollection from the standpoint of forgiveness. So, the way in which... The way in which we put together subject becoming substance, substance becoming subject, the new thought we need is not any new content, but to make sense of what it means to be looking at those histories in the way we already had but didn't know we had, namely from this standpoint of accepting. Now, what's required for this? How is achieving this absolute standpoint possible? And there are two theses, and I have 10 minutes, so I guess each thesis will have to get 5 minutes. Nothing like transferring quality into quantity. One is the idea of a speculative proposition, and the other is, of course, what he has to say about time. The notion of the speculative proposition, speculative sentences, occurs in paragraph 23, and then again in paragraphs 59, 60. And what the discussion of the speculative sentence is trying to think about is, and this is obviously means thinking about representational thought, is how can we understand ordinary subject-predicate judgments? How can we understand the structure of subject and predicate that all Western thought, from Aristotle through Kant, took to be fundamental, right? Substance and accident, the subject I, synthesizing the subject term and the predicate term. Well, Hegel begins by noting a semantic peculiarity of both English and German, namely that the same term that is used to characterize individual consciousness is the term that is used to characterize the grammatical unit of which something is said to be a predicate. That is, being a subject, that's me, picks out a subject, say you, and offers a predicate, right? Is puzzled. Right? Now, Hegel thinks that this fact is a clue, not a justification, for what he's going to argue. And what he's going to argue is the propositions that interest him are propositions of essential predication. That is, where one thing is said to be the essence of another thing. So, God is being. That looks like a bit of essential predication. And he says, well, what's the deal with God is being? Well, we have a name, and we say the essence of that name is being. And then he says, but this is a bit puzzling. And why is it a bit puzzling? Because he says, what happened to the subject term? If the subject term, the essence of it is being, we don't need the subject term anymore. We can just say, being. Well, that sounds pretty inarticulate. What happens in that moment of inarticulateness? And his answer is that as we come to that recognition, we lose our relationship of externality to what we were determining. That is, our capacities as judgers seem to depend upon me, a subject, saying this is the subject and this is the predicate. And that I, as it were, can contemplate the object, which is to say my distance from the object, depends upon that separation. But as soon as that separation looks to be a bit of artifice, he says, I lose my place as subject. That is, as observer of something of which I am wholly independent. So the claim is that subject-predicate grammar is a form of mastery. A form of mastery that depends upon an externality of the subject to the object. So the hint he wants to exploit here is that subject-predicate grammar is the source of subject-object dualism. That our sense that we have a world that is external to us, that we merely judge, is actually, just as Nietzsche will say later, a bit of grammatical illusion. But then if it turns out that I don't have this position of mastery, then I cannot think myself as outside of what I'm determining, but I must think of the relationship between me and the object as part of a, this is all Hegel wants to say, as part of a perpetual movement. Without a particular telos or end or control. Let's say that it's a continual movement of determination. That instead of having rigid determinacy, there's the subject, there's the predicate, but Scott gets beat up again. That's what this course has secretly been about. That's the return of the press. Instead of having that mastery, what we have is continual attempts to determine ourselves by determining the object, and that we cannot separate those two moments. So the first thing that disappears and needs to disappear in order for absolute knowing to occur is we need to lose the idea that we are spectators. Well, spectators on what? Well, how about the view that we are spectators on history, for openers. That history is what exists out there, and as we write it, we are contemplating something that exists absolutely independently of us and has its own structure. Well, what supports that idea, that history is absolutely independent of us and exists out there? How about the belief that time is a container? That time is a form of intuition in which things are given a temporal place. So the one assumption that Hegel suggests in paragraph 801 that we have not questioned up till now is Kant's idea that time is a form of intuition. Because if time is a form of intuition, then events occur in time and get their temporal location in time. So Hegel suggests, and now we're coming to the thesis that we have to go from the Christian time design to a different conception of temporality. So Hegel wants to say in paragraph 801, we require a transposition of our understanding of time. So he says, time is the concept. Not the concept occurs in time, or the concept, but rather, time is the concept itself that is there. Time is the concept. And I think at the end, if what's confusing about the sentence is really the conjunction. It makes much more sense if you read the and as but. So instead of und, have aber. So time is the notion itself that is there, but which presents itself to consciousness as an empty intuition. And the empty intuition, that's the giveaway. That he's here trying to overcome the Kantian conception of time. Right? Because time is not an empty intuition. What is time? Time is the self-movement of spirit. That is, we need to move from a conception of history to a conception of historicity. By which I mean to say that we need to think of time not as an external container that has events in it, in the past and some in the future, but time as who we are in our continual movement of determination as I've said throughout, as a community of the living and the day.
If that's what the concept is, history itself,
self-movement of time, then of course it follows, right, that the gathering up is going to be, and this is all I needed to use from the secular proposition, a self-gathering. Right? Because now there's no externality, there's no history out there.
That was the illusion that the form of judgment, Kant's greatest discovery, trashed in 25 years, so much of his great discoveries. And moving beyond that to conceptual thought. What conceptual thought means now is thought that is, in a fundamental sense, groundless. That is, nothing but what we do as historical, recognitive beings who are grounded in our possibilities through the forms in which we recognize one another in the present and as a community of the living and the dead. Just there. That was fun.